This is Jerry Conway, and you're listening to Superior Spider Talk. Now, don't get too close to the edge of that bridge.
Welcome to Superior Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavostin, and I'm the editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm Mark Giannacchio, the editor of the Chasing Amazing blog.
Thanks for joining us for the 31st episode of Superior Spider Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we hope to look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a bit of a bigger picture.
Yes, and Dan, 31 seems to be a special number in the Spider-Man world these days, and I guess in kind, Superior Spider Talk has a really special episode lined up for episode 31.
Yeah, boy do we.
Yeah, this is one of our Superior Spider Talk and Amazing Friends episodes, and this friend is pretty amazing. We will be speaking with Jerry Conway, the legendary writer who, you know, will describes himself as the man who killed Gwen Stacy, but has a huge legacy to his name, but this conversation is going to be mostly focused on Goblin-related material, especially with Goblin Nation, you know, in full tilt right now. But Dan, this is an exciting one, so I hope our listeners really enjoy this.
Yeah, if you guys want to skip to a specific section or skip right to the interview, you can do so by using your chapter selection arrows on your player. And if you hear this sound, please check out your iOS device for a link to an article, video, or image to enhance your listening experience, although I don't know how much better it can get than this awesome interview with Jerry Conway. So I hope you guys really enjoy it, like Mark said, and let's take it away, Jerry.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends, Iceman and Firestar.
Okay, well, Dan and I have a really super special guest with us today on Superior Spider Talk. We're talking with legendary Marvel writer Jerry Conway, who, had a very historic run on Amazing Spider-Man during the 1970s, and then came back for Web Spider-Man in the 80s and did a lot of things in between. Right, Jerry?
I was still writing comics, but for the determined opposition.
Right. The distinguished competition, right?
that's pretty, yeah. I think that's how we used to refer to it.
But obviously, with Goblin Nation in full swing right now, we thought this was an excellent time to get Jerry on Superior Spider Talk, because Jerry is responsible for two very iconic Green Goblin related stories. One of which was Harry Osborn becoming the Goblin, and then there was some other story you did, Jerry, that was people kind of call it the end of the Silver Age. So
but I put a stake right through it. not intentionally, but I guess in retrospect, that's what we do.
It's also an interesting time to have you on with the new movie coming out, because it seems as though they're doing your story.
It appears that way, and as I've said to a few other people when we've talked about it, I'm desperately hoping they will, because that way Mark Webb will become the most hated man in comics and not me. So because if he kills off Gwen Stacy, it'll be great. I'll be able to wash my hands of it. So
it's an elite club of Gwen killers.
I was going to say, after the first movie, I thought Emma Stone was the best part of the first movie. So she's really good. That's a double
really
whammy.
and what's brilliant about it, not to denigrate the memory of Gwen Stacy as a character, but I've always contended that she was somebody who was far more memorable after she was killed off than she would have been if she had stayed around. She was kind of a white bread, very bland sort of character, in my opinion. That's why I didn't mind killing her off, obviously. But Emma Stone has made her so likable and lovable that I think, you know, audiences are going to be horribly traumatized, and I will be personally delighted that they are. It's really a tribute to her talent as an actress that she's made that character as interesting as it is.
Well, it's funny because I was talking to my girlfriend before we came on here, and I said I was talking to you, and I explained to her, like, you know, in kind of terms that she could understand. And I said, "Oh, the guy who killed off Gwen Stacy," and she's like, "Oh, that's such an awful thing. Like, I love Gwen, you know." And I was trying to explain to her, no, Gwen is, like, more interesting dead. I understand in your mind she's not.
Right. Well, that's going to be fascinating because what we have to remember is that the people who know about Gwen Stacy as a character and know her importance in the history of Spider-Man and to the storyline, you know, in Spider-Man, is an extremely small percentage of the audience for the Spider-Man movies. So you've got sort of a replication in what's happening in these new films, a replication of the events of 1973-74, you know, where the audience at that time was shocked, you know, and thrown for a complete loop by Gwen's death. And in the same sort of way, that's going to happen to the vast majority of the viewers who go see Amazing Spider-Man, assuming that she does in fact die in this second film. You know, it's going to be huge for them in a way that we can't begin to imagine. It's going to be Luke's father all over again. I mean, nowadays, you know, Luke's father, it's a cliche, right? But, you know, back in 84 when Return of the Jedi, or 82, whenever, not Return of the Jedi, Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, it was, I think, 80, actually.
Yeah, it's 80.
When that came out, I mean, that was just a mind-boggling revelation. And again, now, you know, 40 years later, 30, 40 years later, you know, it's old news. But, you know, for a vast majority of these viewers, it's going to be complete shock. And I can't wait to hear their reaction.
Do you think there's anyone out there that's shocked at Uncle Ben's murder?
No, because I think that contextually is more part of the mythology of the character. I mean, you kind of know, I think, if you know anything about Spider-Man, especially if your only familiarity with Spider-Man is the cartoons and the TV show, I mean, the TV cartoons and the first run of movies, you know that Spider-Man is formed as a character by the fact that he let his uncle, in effect, let his uncle die. So that's sort of like seminal to his creation, and it's sort of part of the mythology, like Bruce Wayne's parents are dead, you know, Superman's from another planet, you know, and so on. But the Gwen Stacy storyline is an addendum, you know, to that original creation. It doesn't overshadow it, but it adds an extra frisson of horror, you know, to the life of being a superhero. You know, it's just that being a superhero isn't about just the successes, you know, of your heroism, but the tragedies that can occur simply because you're in that life. And I think that was the first time we really dealt with it in comics. And I think that's why it had such a huge impact. And I think this will be the first time it's really dealt with. Although, to be fair, I guess you could say Batman, the second Batman movie with, you know, the death of, I'm sorry, the third Batman movie with the death of, which one? It was Harvey Dent in second one.
The second
one. Yeah, right. With the death of Batman's girlfriend, you know, who wasn't really as important, I think, in his life, you know, as Gwen Stacy. I think this will be the first time that viewers of comic book movies have been confronted with that potential reality. I think that's going to be kind of cool.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, without question, you know, it's funny. I was before we got into specific storylines, I was going to lead you with a general question. We already started kind of getting into Gwen stuff, but let me backtrack a little bit, Jared,
sure.
for people who want to know more about you beyond just the fact that you killed Gwen.
yeah, because there is a little more.
now you started working on Amazing in your early 20s, right?
Yeah, I was. I think I was just 19, wow. 19, 20. Yeah.
So, I mean, what was it like for you at that age to not only be, you know, get on Amazing, but you were essentially Stan's replacement? I mean, like, what was going through your head for, you know, especially at such a young age?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that I Marvel was such a small company when I started working for them. They were publishing like 10 to 15 titles a month when I came on. And you really had a very small writing staff. It was I was brought in to back up Roy Thomas, who was backing up Stan, and so that was it. You know, and then we had I think Gary Friedrich and a handful of other freelancers who would, you know, show up for individual fill-in issues. But I guess I was kind of Larry Lieber, you know, in a sense. I was the guy who would come in and do the stories that Stan or Roy couldn't do. And I was aware that there was this possibility that eventually I would move up the ranks. I think the first title of Stan's that he gave up that I took over was Thor. I think it was about 6 months or maybe a year before I took over Spider-Man. So I was accustomed to the idea that I might get into that role. And I knew that Roy really didn't want to write Spider-Man, so that if Stan ever did leave that book, I would be the person who would be likely to take it over. And at age 18, 19, 20, your sense of your own capacity to do things is pretty enormous. I mean, my self-confidence was untempered by reality. I think I felt like, yeah, I could do that. You know, it was like, yeah, I could do that. It was pretty arrogant, but, you know, at the same time, in a weird sort of way, I felt very simpatico with Peter Parker. I was the same age, theoretically, that he was. We had a similar life background, although obviously I didn't get bitten by a spider and I didn't live with my sick aunt. But, you know, we both were kids from Queens. You know, we both had kind of misfit adolescence. We were both young adult men trying to figure out how to combine relationships and career in New York City. And it was so I kind of felt like I knew that guy, and I really passionately wanted to write him. So when the time came, you know, I just took to it like, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do.
And then once you were writing full time, I mean, how much input did Stan Lee still have on the books? I mean, was he just kind of really in the background by that point? Or
Stan really wanted to hand everything off, and he did. He didn't really oversee the material on a day-to-day basis. Roy had more of an impact, but even Roy had the philosophy that if you were the guy that he wanted to do the work, it's because he liked what you did, and so he wasn't going to second guess you. In the first year or so that I worked on the book, I collaborated primarily with John Romita, who was the senior partner in the relationship, obviously. His name even came first, you know, in the credits for my first dozen issues, or half dozen issues, whatever number it was that we worked on together when he was penciling. And he pretty much took me in hand and taught me how to plot the books the way that Stan would have plotted them, you know, and guided me and kept me from, you know, too much too excessive, you know, a use of my own ideas. And so, you know, I was gradually given more and more authority and more ability to pace the stories and develop the stories myself as time went by.
Go, Dan.
there's so much talk by, like, Stan, the way he kind of sells the bullpen and everything, like the Marvel offices in the comics. Like, what was the environment, like, at the time like there? I mean, like, were people actually working in the office or?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the people who wrote – well, let me backtrack. There was the offices were fairly small. When I first started working for Marvel – I think we had three big rooms on Madison Avenue, right over a floor above the offices of the National Lampoon, actually. And they were – we had John Romita and Herb Trimpe were the two artists who worked every day at the office. Both of them drew there. Trimpe, I think, just preferred to be there because he didn't want. He also had a part-time relationship as a production artist for Marvel, so that if there were corrections that needed to be made or, you know, redrawing that needed to be done on a book, Herb was one of the people who would do it. So he had to work there, and then John was there because he was the art director. And again, you know, if a cover design had to be done, he would be the one to do it, so he had to be there. But everybody else worked from home. We all, you know, wrote our scripts at home. I think Roy would write at the office. Stan would sometimes write at the office, but they had kind of semi-private offices. The bullpen itself, you know, was open. So you didn't have if you were an artist, you might be able to work. But if you were a writer, you might have been too noisy. Although I think a Starbucks today is probably noisier than that would have been. And a lot of people write their scripts at Starbucks. So I don't know. But it was a fairly small operation. You know, when I first started, there was, as I say, 10 to 15 titles. So it was not really much of a bullpen.
I say, I think Marvel put out 10 to 15 titles this week.
Yeah. I mean, within about 3 years, they were up to 50 titles a month, and they didn't change their editorial administrative stance until years later. So it was kind of chaotic and crazy. They just sort of expanded without ever hiring more staff. So it was kind of lunacy.
Now, I just wanted to ask, you know, you mentioned John Romita earlier. Now, I mean, and if I'm leaving somebody out, I apologize. But in terms of other pencilers you worked on, you know, on your first run on Amazing, there was Gil Kane and Ross Andrew, right? Those were the two other main ones. I mean, was the creative process generally the same with each artist, or, I mean, you know?
No, not really. I mean, Romita was, as I say, more of Romita and Ross Andrew were more direct collaborators. Romita, in particular, I deferred to Romita because, as I say, he was the senior partner in it, and he obviously knew everything much better than I would have known. So when I was working with John, I would run ideas by him. He would take them and develop the story, you know, visually. And I don't think I ever wrote a full length plot for him after the first one that I did. With Gil Kane, Gil was very inventive visually and was a good storyteller, but he didn't really contribute to plot. His contributions were in terms of the overall design, layout, and storytelling of the issues that we did together. And because he was kind of known for sometimes pacing things a little bit awkwardly, where he would use, like, say, if you gave him a 3-page plot, he might end up doing the first page over the first 16 pages of a 20-page book, and you'd end up with everything crowded into the last 4 pages. I became very careful with Gil about specifically saying, okay, this is going to take 3 pages of pencils, this will take 4 pages of pencils, and so on. So I was more hands-on with Gil about pacing the stories. With Ross Andrew, it was sort of it was back to working with someone who was really good at plot and story. And Ross and I consider really a perfect collaboration where the two of us were equal partners in developing the stories together, with the exception of a handful of stories that I wrote full script while he was penciling the book. He was a terrific storyteller and a great collaborator.
And he always had a lot of detail with his mm-hmm. backgrounds too. I mean, like, people, you know, I know a lot of people talk about, like, how he would always work in, like, you know, these real life buildings and icons and things like that. I mean, was that just all him all the way, or?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to the point where, because I knew that he liked to do that, I would specifically say, we're going to do this one at this location. We would talk about locations around the city that we found visually interesting and that we wanted to use. So we would find ways to put those into the stories. And he actually came to I lived up in the west side of Manhattan while we were working together. And he would come to my apartment building and take pictures off the roof. So there's some scenes of that spider band literally were swinging by my apartment building. So it was very cool. We actually got in trouble once because Ross was so good about wanting references for things. We did a story called Mindworm, about a character called the Mindworm, that's about this kind of mutant kid, you know, who has this ability to do telepathic mind control or something. And Ross found this house in his neighborhood down in Howard Beach, Queens, that he thought would be a great house for this guy to be in, because it was on this kind of the only house surrounded by vacant lots, and it was kind of eerie and weird. So he used it as a reference. Unfortunately, it was recognizable, and people started, local fans started going to the house and asking if the Mindworm lived there. And we ended up, Marvel ended up getting sued by the owners of the house, and we had to pay them off, I think. So from that point on, we were careful to disguise our references.
I have not heard that story, Dan. Have you heard that one?
No, I mean, no. All over the Mindworm. That's great.
I'm going to say, I mean, I know that issue, but I didn't realize.
You go look at it. That house exists. It really, or it did back in the 1970s. Yeah.
Well, Mark, we're going there.
Yeah. We got to find this house now.
Down Howard Beach somewhere.
Yeah. Let's say, I have a friend. Well, he used to live in Rockaway, but he actually has since moved to Tennessee. He went total south on us, but I'll have to ask him if he knows that story, because he might.
Sure.
So in terms of, you know, kind of backtracking again to now going back to Gwen Stacy related material. I've read, you know, in certain books or in interviews, you know, there's all these accounts in terms of, you know, when this decision was made and who knew, who was on board, whatever. I mean, from your perspective, when did you know this was going to happen in terms of killing off Gwen?
Well, we had been talking about doing something to shake up the book. And John Romita was a prime instigator in wanting to do something dramatic, you know, to give the book a sense of consequence and stakes. So he felt he referred to the Milk Caniff storytelling techniques of Steve Canyon and Terry and the Pirates, of where you use where you do a story where a beloved character, some beloved character, dies, and that raises the stakes, you know, for everybody. You know, it raises the stakes for the reader, in that the reader now knows that, yes, in this universe, bad things can happen, you know, and so therefore I have to pay more attention to those stories. And for the writers and artists, it raises a stakes, because it, you know, it gets your juices flowing and reminds you that you are doing material that has consequence. So he wanted to do something that would do that. His vote was to kill off Aunt May. He felt that Aunt May, you know, had outlived her usefulness and the time was ripe for her to die. And I disagreed with this for a couple of reasons. I mean, my thought at the time was, and this is less relevant today, but at the time, Aunt May was a connection with Peter's reason for being Spider-Man. She was a daily reminder, you know, of that with great power comes great responsibility. She was his connection both to his parents, who had vanished, you know, from his life, and to his uncle, who, you know, is part of his mythic story. So I felt she still had value as a character. And besides which, I always enjoyed the stories in which, you know, she's at death's door or involved in some bizarre storyline that puts her in jeopardy. I just like, you know, as a reader, I enjoyed that. But I had this long-term gripe with the book, which was when I had started reading Spider-Man, I was a reader from like issue 2, I think. And the whole Mary Jane introduction was one of my favorite moments in comic book history. You know, where she's you're teased with her for several months beforehand, where she's held out, you know, as this kind of mysterious figure that Aunt May and her friend Mrs. Watson are trying to set Peter up with, and Peter's trying to dodge it desperately, you know, like, oh my God, you know, I don't want to be a setup with some girl, you know, that's going to end up being a monster in some way. And then the reveal that she was not just cool, but I mean, not just beautiful, but cool. You know, I mean, she had that very snappy, immediately you could tell she was going to be Peter's equal, you know. I mean, face a tiger, you've hit the jackpot. I mean, that is a self-confident, funny, balls-to-the-wall type woman. And I loved her. And then she went away. Yeah. I mean, she went away as Peter's girlfriend. And I was devastated. I was like, what happened here? You know, this is obviously supposed to be his girlfriend. And suddenly now this other girl is his girlfriend. And I never understood it. But I understood it from a personal point of view because Stan Lee married, was and had been married for a long time to a lovely woman named Joan, who is a dead ringer for Gwen Stacy. And his daughter, Joni Jr., is another dead ringer for Gwen Stacy. And Stan was basically fulfilling his own wishes, you know, that Peter would end up with a woman just like his wife. But that did not ring true to me. It just did. There was nothing about Gwen that said to me, this is Peter's inevitable love interest. Emma Stone has made her a interesting character. I mean, think about all the things about her that make her interesting. She's witty. She's sharp. She's gorgeous, but also self-confident. She puts Peter down in a way that's, you know, very direct, and she's Mary Jane.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, she is totally Mary Jane. That is Mary Jane. Of course, if Emma Stone had kept her hair color, you know, and they just stayed with casting her like two movies later, you know, she could be Mary Jane. But no, they had to do this. So in effect, I felt like they had taken a wrong step with Gwen Stacy, and this was my chance to set it right. So I suggested, let's do Gwen Stacy. And believe me, nobody objected. Yeah. Nobody. Stan was on board. Roy was on board. John was like, yeah, that sounds fine. I think it was the manner in which she died and the fatal snap that people later, and with justification, probably felt was my doing more than their doing. So they wanted to get their hands off of it. You know, it's like, you know, but although now, you know, everybody would like to probably claim credit for it because it's like become so iconic. But at the time, I don't think anybody quite, I mean, certainly Stan didn't know that that's how it was done. Roy, I think, noticed it, but probably didn't. It didn't track with him, you know, that that's what we were implying. I don't even think that I consciously even recognized what it was that I was implying. I was responding to what Gil had drawn, which, you know, from the angle in which that he had drawn Mary Jane and the motion of her body, it was pretty clear that her neck was snapping. So I just added the sound effect. And the shit storm rained down. That's the backstory.
Did you suspect that neck snapping would open up this whole other line of questioning over, like, whether she was already dead or not?
Well, I wanted to have my cake and eat it too, you know. So I put in the whole reference, you know, the goblin saying that, you know, she'd be dead on the way down, you know, that whole thing, which is all nonsense. I mean, unless he had killed her before he threw her off, a fall doesn't kill you. The landing kills you. Yeah. You know, that's what killed you. or your neck snapping from whiplash kills you. You know, it was a bit of a namby-pamby moment on my part, but it was also kind of traditional in comics to try to soften the blow. And this was really a transitional story. Again, not intentionally. None of us were saying to ourselves, we're going to change the business, you know, and make things more real. It was simply that was the arc that we were on. You know, we were moving towards a more realistic portrayal of comics. You have these artifacts, you know, that sort of hang around from the prior age. And that one of the artifacts was, you know, the notion that we could escape blame somehow by saying she fell and she died from the rapidity of her fall.
Well, kind of jumping off that, I think it was around the time that Amazing Spider-Man 700 had come out and Dan Slott was getting death threats about what he did to Peter and everything. And you had made, and I'm paraphrasing, a comment on Twitter, right, where you were like, if Twitter was around when I killed Gwen Stacy, you know, like the shitstorm would have been off the charts, right?
And, yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, I guess it's hard to put yourself, but I mean, if that story was done today and had the impact it still had, I mean, would you, I mean, you're obviously, you're involved in Twitter, you're on social media. I mean, would you be still willing to put yourself out there?
I did not have any idea back in 73 that I was going to be the recipient of as much hatred as I received. In fact, it was so severe. And this is before you had social media or any of this. I mean, basically all you had were letters, you know, and conventions, you know, comic book conventions. And the conventions were small. I mean, 300 to 500 to 1,000, 2,000 people. That was a big convention. But I was on the receiving end of a lot of hate mail. I mean, probably more hate mail than I think they'd ever received at Marvel up to that point. And a lot of abuse at conventions. I mean, people just, you know, being really obnoxious. And I stopped going to conventions and I stopped reading mail. I just had to, like, back off of that for a long time. I mean, it was just really impossible to put up with it. So I think the big difference between now and 73 is that today our readership is more cynical. I mean, one of my other tweets regarding you know, the Dan Slott story, it was simply to say something to the effect of, oh my God, you know, they've killed off a major character. what will happen? You know, will he ever return? Like, you know, I mean, nowadays, you know, characters get killed off and they're back a year and a half later. And guess what? You know, that's pretty much been the arc of Superior Spider-Man. I had no doubt in my mind that Peter was going to be back. I mean, it was just, and I don't think anybody who seriously follows comics had any doubt that Peter would not be back. But when Gwen Stacy died, we were much less cynical about comics. So people took it very, very seriously, and it was and in fact, she's the only major character I think who's ever been killed off, who's never come back. With the, you know, if you don't count the clone stories, and honestly, I don't. You know, I mean, I count them as stories, but I don't count them as her having come back. So when she was made dead, she was stayed dead. So, and that's a big difference between what happens now. And I think social media, I'm thunderstruck by readers who take these things as serious disruptions. I'm just like flabbergasted that anybody thought for a minute that Peter Parker is gone forever. How could anybody be that naive, you know? Yet that's what we see, you know, and I mean, remember the big media brouhaha when Superman was killed?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Right. Superman's dead. Captain America. Oh my God, he's dead. You know, oh my God, they killed Kenny. I mean, it's like, you know, we can't take this stuff seriously anymore. And I think part of the social media, response to these things is just kind of bewildering to me, because I don't understand why anybody takes it as other than, hey, that's a cool storyline. You know, I mean, I personally love the Superior Spider-Man storyline. I thought it was a really interesting way to drum up some interest in the character and give us a new perspective on Spider-Man and ask some interesting questions about what it means to be a superhero. And all of that was great. But it was also obvious from the get-go that it was going to be a temporary storyline. If for no other reason than that there's a $1 million movie coming, guys, you know, right. It's called Amazing Spider-Man. And, you know, they're not going to let that go away.
No. I mean, Dan and I talk about this a lot when we review the issues with Superior. I mean, like we both maintain that, you know, a lot of what Superior about is, I mean, it's a referendum on what it is to be Spider-Man. You know, I mean, like Peter might be dead, quote unquote, but I mean, he's all over those issues, you know, like sure. Whether it's, I mean, it's, he's the measuring stick for how Otto does what he does. So it's
absolutely.
Like, so even, absolutely. So even if he's not physically there, he's still there. And, you know,
yeah. it's very true. I mean, and I think that was what was so great about them too, is that they gave you another perspective on the whole story. You know, I mean, it's, there's a little chill, you know, that goes down your spine when you see certain things that remind you of how Peter would have behaved, or what the repercussions would have been if Peter had done that, you know, and so on. I mean, that's just fascinating, and I think that was a great literary ploy on Marvel's part, that Dan executed it brilliantly.
We have some suspicions that they have introduced a character, Anna Maria, into the book as Otto's like girlfriend in the body of Peter, and we have suspicions that she might be getting the axe in a similar style as Gwen, and we've had a couple readers like write in, and we've been talking about it too, this whole like women in a fridge concept. That, like,
yeah.
What are your feelings like? You know, as someone who kind of like killed the, you know, quintessential like, you know superhero girlfriend and kind of change the attitude towards that, like about how that stuff is being handled today and like maybe how it's being like read differently. I mean, do you have feelings on that?
Well, it is fascinating. I've always kind of considered myself a feminist, but I realized in recent years that my perception of women's role is filtered through, you know, a kind of obviously filtered through a male perspective, and I have huge blinders, you know, that I'm trying to remove, you know, which are just automatic kind of, well, yeah, that's the way things are, you know, sort of assumptions. So yes, I think it's unfortunate that women are still and supporting characters in general, but women as supporting characters are generally treated as potential victims, you know, rather than as assertive individuals in their own right. I mean, to some degree, inevitably, if you're doing a male-centric character, I mean, if your male lead is a character and he has relationships, unless the relationship is with another guy, there's going to be a certain sexual component to it that's going to be there. You know what I mean? He's going to have a girlfriend.
Sure.
Or he's going to have a wife, or he's going to have and inevitably, because the story is actually about the lead character, the secondary character is going to be secondary by definition. You know, she's the secondary character. And so as a result, you have to really work at it to not treat her as an appendage. You have to, like, give her a and I think we've to varying degrees, I, as a writer, have been a failure at this or a success at this, you know, I mean, at different times in my career. But there is a tendency to just automatically put her in the fridge or throw her off a building or, you know, put a tire to the railroad tracks, you know, I mean, something that puts her in a victimized position so that the hero has some reason for doing, you know, for rushing to her rescue. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, but it's also kind of integral to the drama of any story where you have a lead character and a supporting character. The supporting character is going to end up needing to be in a subordinate role. That being said, I think that it's incumbent upon writers and artists to not treat that subordinate role as automatically as a weaker character or as a less developed character, and to not take the easy out of putting them in jeopardy just because that makes for a greater, you know, a stronger suspense for the lead character. There has to be other, you know, there has to be a way to sort of treat them as equals, you know, is what I would say. But recognizing that ultimately they're not equals because one is the protagonist and one is not. You know, in a book that's featuring, that's built around a female character, then she should be the main character, and subordinate character will be whoever she's in a relationship with. You know, and that person will be in jeopardy. and in Batwoman, it'll be another woman, you know, and in Batgirl, it might be a guy. I mean, you know, it could be any number of things. But we have to be conscious of not taking the easy out, is what I'm saying.
Awesome.
Yeah, definitely. Jerry, just out of curiosity, I mean, why was Green Goblin chosen as the guy to do this? I mean, you know, fans will debate back and forth about, you know, who is the arch villain for Spidey. And, you know, obviously, you know, you read Superior right now, and it would seem that Doc Ock is kind of the guy since he successfully got into his skin. But I mean, did you know from the get-go, if you were going to do this story, like, it had to be Green Goblin?
Well, it's interesting because in my view, Green Goblin, I mean, while Doc Ock and Sandman and Vulture, you know, were all important members of the Spider-Man rogues gallery, Green Goblin, for some reason, always, I guess because, as I say, I read those books from the beginning, and I was fascinated by the Goblin storyline when it was originally played out, where, you know, you had this mysterious figure, I mean, this villain who shows up, who doesn't seem to have a secret identity. We don't know what his secret identity is. But there's implications that he's vitally important in Peter's life. That there's a personal connection. And of course, all of that is retro-conned, you know, because I guarantee Stan and Steve, when they created him, didn't have Harry Osborn in mind and didn't have Norman Osborn in mind. In fact, they weren't even introduced until after the Goblin came along. But be that as it may, Peter had a personal relationship with Norman Osborn that he didn't have with any of the other villains in his life. So, in my mind, the Green Goblin was always Peter's arch enemy. And if you're going to have, you know, this fatal consequence, you know, where his Joker, basically, kills his girlfriend and then is himself killed, you want it to be a character of consequence to him emotionally, in addition to just being, you know, the big bad. You know, he's got to have some emotional connection. And it was in my mind that Harry would make a terrific replacement goblin, and that, you know, I could have my cake and eat it too. I could have a goblin die, and I could bring the goblin back, and it would make perfect sense structurally and emotionally. So it seemed like, you know, it seemed like an inevitability to me at the time.
Yeah. So you had Harry in mind early on. Yeah. It sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a question of something that's kind of always bothered me, and Mark and I were reviewing the New Ways to Die storyline last week on the show, and it brought up this back up in my head. In the book, it says that they're at the GW Bridge, but it's clearly the Brooklyn Bridge. What is the story behind
this
confusion?
What the fuck is that?
Yeah, yeah. What is that?
What is that? Well, what that was that in my outline, I referred to it as the GW Bridge. And when he drew it, Gil Kane drew the Brooklyn Bridge, I believe, or it could be reversed. I'm not sure. It's been so long. And when I wrote the script, I was looking at my outline and I was really not paying that close attention because I was so involved in the emotions of the scene. You know, I wasn't paying that much attention to the place. So I just referred to it as the George Washington Bridge or whatever, you know, whichever one it is, because I'm still confused to this day.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I needed, you know, I just sort of, I guess I just wasn't paying close enough attention, and it was a confusion that sort of arrived between the two of us. And I think honestly that the obviously the Brooklyn Bridge is a visually a much better choice, so Gil made the better choice. I had wanted the George Washington Bridge just simply because I hadn't seen that part of Manhattan in a comic, you know, and I guess I was going for the anti-iconic approach. So, but it's one of those things where you could sort of say, see, this is the secret history, you know, and there's a conspiracy, you know, but maybe this didn't actually happen. Maybe it's all a dream.
It's no prize worthy.
Yeah, definitely no prize worthy. And yours is in the mail.
Yes, I've always wanted one.
Well, now you won't have one. So I always love no prizes. I actually got one once.
Did you really?
They actually, yeah, they sent out these little envelopes with no prize in them. You know, it was like you'd get this envelope from Marvel, and it had, you know, the drawing of the Hulk on it, I think it was, and a big announcement, here's your no prize, and you open it up and there's nothing in it. Love it.
Jerry, at the end of, I mean, we obviously touched on Mary Jane earlier, but you know, the scene, it's one of my favorite scenes with the character, and might even be my favorite scene in Amazing Spider-Man 122, that epilogue with, yeah, Mary Jane coming. So I mean, I guess the first question is, I mean, was there any bit of, you know, caution in terms of hypothetically setting Peter in the same setting as a prior romantic interest, and, you know, in the same storyline where his current girlfriend died? I mean, was that, did you have any caution? But I mean, was that also like your clear signal that this is the direction that you wanted the character to go romantically?
Well, I wanted to accomplish a couple of things. I mean, and we actually, that sequence was redrawn because the way that that Gil had done it didn't provide the same sort of closure that I think it provides now. So John Romita redrew the last two or three panels. I didn't want us to leave this storyline with no hope for Peter, you know, that he was obviously devastated and destroyed emotionally, and so were the readers, you know, going to be devastated and destroyed emotionally by this story. But I didn't want to leave it at that, you know, where there is no sense that life will not go on in some way. But I also didn't want it to feel like he's going to pick things up and everything is going to be happy and he's going to be right back into a relationship with another girl. I wanted it to feel like she's his friend first here, you know, that he needs somebody who's going to be able to accept his pain at this moment, you know, someone who is going to be able to hear him and not walk away from him while he's at this lowest point of his life. And that's what that was. I was trying to communicate with that, but also at the same time, you know, give us a sense that, you know, that she's available to him as a potential, you know, future romantic interest, but without crossing that line. You know, I mean, it was a very, very delicate line to sort of to be on. And so there's no sense that they're going to kiss and embrace and all of that. You know, it's she's going to be there for him, you know, while he's in his pain. And I think that was really all. That's why the door closes, you know, on the two of them, so they can have that private space.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, to me, that's always just a scene where she totally evolves into a
Grows up.
Yeah,
she grows up in that two pages. That's where she makes her choice of who she's going to be. So I was really happy with that too.
How do you feel about their eventual marriage?
I thought it was a disastrous mistake. I've said this, you know, in other contexts, and it probably marks me out, you know, as a bit of a conservative. I don't mean politically conservative, but culturally conservative. I tend to think that there are reasons why characters are iconic, and that they represent certain moments in our development as human beings. You know, like and they speak to us during those moments in our development as human beings. And Spider-Man, in my mind, I mean, if I were to be a complete perfectionist, I would never have had him graduate from high school. But beyond that, he is a young man, in my view, he's a young man struggling on the cusp of adulthood, coming to terms with the power, the responsibilities of adult power. I mean, that's the metaphor, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Spider-Man is somebody who, like every adolescent, is subtly empowered, you know, as he gains adult powers, you know, he gains adult authority, but he's not an adult. He's a kid, and he's trying to figure it out. And that's why he's such a great iconic character, right? You know, that he's trying to make sense of this new power that he has, while still dealing with all the consequences of adolescent insecurity and childhood uncertainty. So he's the cusp character. He's a character who's on the cusp of things. And that's why, you know, the Spider-Man movies are about him as a teenager, you know, moving towards adulthood. They're not about him as a young adult dealing with job issues and, you know, whether he's going to get a degree or not get a degree. I mean, none of that. You know, that's not what they're about. They're about the icon, which is Peter Parker, young kid, learning to be a grown-up. So given that, marriage for a character like Peter Parker is crossing the threshold into adulthood. It's now you're an adult. Act like one. You know, it's like now you're grown up. You know, you've gotten married. You're an adult. You have adult responsibilities. Put away your childish things. Stop being a kid. So it changes the character, and it becomes less interesting. He's not Spider-Man anymore, in my view. He's not Peter Parker on the cusp. He's over the edge. You know, he's in the adult world. So, as I say, it's kind of this culturally conservative attitude that I have, that we as readers come to different characters at crucial moments in our lives when they speak to us. And that's where those characters belong, you know, at that crucial moment. Problem that comic book readers have and the comic book writers have is that we keep reading the damn things. Mm. You know, we read them as we get older, and our life changes, and our life needs change. And now we want to be spoken to at this new stage of our lives. But rather than look for new characters or new voices that will speak to us, we want our old characters to become relevant to us in our new stage of life. And by doing so, we wrench them out of the area where they belong and bring them into an area where they may not belong. The result is that we're cheating the reader who might discover those characters at the crucial moment in their lives when they need to read them. And we're sort of distorting and adulterating these characters into something that they're not by making them relevant to our middle-aged lives or our late adult, you know, our late young adult lives or whatever it is. So, in that sense, I think all these characters should be magically frozen in time and kept where they belong, you know, and Peter Pan shouldn't grow up, you know. I'm not saying that we might not want to have him grow up, or there might not be a relevant place to do a story where Peter Pan grows up, but in terms of the iconic character, to me, Miles Morales is more Peter Parker today than Peter Parker was before Doc Ock took over his body. I have more fun I won't say more fun because I really, really like what Dan Slott is doing with Spider-Man. I'm just saying that the Peter Parker that I read and wanted to read as a kid is the Miles Morales of Ultimate Spider-Man. And that's where that character is today.
And I'm assuming in the same vein you liked Ultimate Peter Parker too, probably, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I understand publishing, you know, has to deal with the reality of the business, which is that our readership got older. But I think we really endanger ourselves as creators when we distort these characters into things that they're not just because we're bored with, you know, the way that they were. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm not like,
yeah. To use your analogy about freezing these characters, now that Peter Parker has been defrosted, do you think he can be refrozen?
Oh, you mean back to the way he was as a teenager? No. I mean, for better or worse, the Spider-Man book is about a young adult named Peter Parker. And that's fine. You know, I mean, it's obviously at this point, you know, that's, he's been that longer than he was the teenage Peter Parker. But I think it's fascinating. Don't you think it's fascinating that when they do the movie versions, which are designed to appeal to millions and millions of people, they choose the teenage version?
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
Well, that's my favorite. Like Ultimate Peter Parker is my favorite character, so.
Yeah. Well, good. We're on the same page.
I mean, kind of related, but not. I mean, in terms of dealing with, you know, moments frozen in time and whatnot, you know, when you know, especially with the storylines we're talking about right now, two major retcons that, you know, related to your stories kind of jump out. I'm just curious what your thoughts are. The fact that Norman Osborn is, you know, has been back for, you know, over 20 years now, and then of course there's that Norman Osborn slept with Gwen Stacy storyline.
That never happened.
I mean, did you read those? I mean, what are your thoughts on like when something like that? I mean, I know that retcons are part of comics, but I mean, like, do you feel that some are more acceptable than others?
I think Norman Osborn being back is probably acceptable because it doesn't change the original story. I mean, in the sense that, you know, she still died. He still killed her. They figured out other ways around that. You know, that's fine. But a retcon that goes against what you know about a character's personality and the history of a character, to my mind, is not a retcon. It's just nonsense. You know, I mean, it's I didn't read that story. I mean, I haven't followed comics as deeply as I sort of follow them on and off, and I get involved in individual storylines and, you know, follow them for a year or two and then go away and then come back, you know, that sort of thing. So I missed the Gwen Stacy Norman Osborn affair. And I'm glad I did, because I would probably have just thrown it against the wall. there's a famous, I don't know if you remember these, but Julie Schwartz did a couple of stories that, I mean, Julie had this tendency to want to explain everything. You know, he wanted to explain everything that happened. And he ended up working with a couple of writers who also had that similar obsession. I wasn't one of them, but every once in a while he would have that. And he did a story explaining why the Flash became the Flash, with the chemicals spilling on him. And, you know, of course, it probably had been bugging him for years, the idea that, oh, my God, a lightning bolt will hit a bunch of chemicals and that will turn him into the Flash. I mean, that's nonsense. It couldn't possibly happen that way. So he came up with this story where this kind of weird wizardy type character comes in and makes the lightning bolt hit. And it's like, what the fuck was that? You know, it's like, and I guarantee at the time that came out, we were all around DC and we were like reading this story going, what the hell is this? You know? And Len Wein said, and I agreed with him instantly. He said, we are making a solemn pact. You know, all of us were standing. He said, we are making a solemn pact. This story never happened. Never happened. Yes, you're right. And it was a similar one was the Wally Cox Superman, magic glasses storyline, where I guess Marty Pasco, who's a wonderful and great writer, but like me, like I said, he has this kind of OCD quality of wanting to explain everything. Apparently had been obsessing for years over the fact that who on earth could possibly mistake, not recognize Clark Kent was Superman. Just because he put on a pair of glasses. There had to be another explanation. What could that explanation possibly be? Well, apparently, according to Marty, remember these glasses that Clark wears have to have been made out of Kryptonian glass because Superman's X-ray vision goes through them and otherwise would have melted them, right? So apparently, without knowing it, since he started wearing the glasses, Superman has been hypnotically using hypnovision through his glasses to hypnotize everybody into thinking that Clark Kent looks like Wally Cox. There is an actual story. There's an actual Superman story where this premise is explicated. And this is also why it works, because he can do it through TV. So whenever Clark Kent would appear on TV or in a camera picture or anywhere, he was hypnotizing people who looked at the picture. I swear to God, this story happened.
That's almost as good as his, like, rainbow finger lasers.
Right. You know, so we just said, no, that never happened. So my attitude about Norman Osborn sleeping with Gwen Stacy and giving birth to whoever it was he gave birth to, that never happened. It never happened.
Well, it also if you do end up accepting it as continuity, I mean, it just changes the dynamic. Right. But it just changes everything about that story that you wrote in terms of
– absolutely.
And like, it's just like, why go there? That's always my –
yeah. I mean – it's like – first of all, it's a useless addition because it gains you nothing.
Right.
Right? I mean, what does it gain you that that Gwen was seduced by – I mean, it's like horrible. I mean, because I have never read the story, and I will never read the story, so yeah. I don't want to –
you don't have
but
to.
I mean, either she's a horrible person for not telling Peter, or she didn't know, in which case she's a victim, which makes her even more pathetic, or Norman Osborn did something to her to make it happen. I mean, it's like, no matter where you go in it, it's ugly. There's just nothing good about it. And so yeah, it makes Norman Osborn even more horrible, but throwing off a bridge wasn't horrible enough? Like, what's your standard here?
Well, let's transition to the stories that have branched off things that you did that are more highly regarded. We spoke to J.M. DeMatteis months ago, and we were asking him about his Spider-Man Harry Osborn, you know, Child Within, and then the Death of Harry story. And you know, he credited what you and Ross did on your issues with Harry as kind of like laying the foundation for this, you know, really kind of emotional and psychological dynamic between the two characters. I mean, what were you going for when you made Harry the Goblin? I mean, just beyond the shock value of it, I mean, what were you thinking about in terms of trying to pit two best friends against each other?
Well, relationships are complicated.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
Yeah. I've had roommates, you know, and actually Len Wein and I were roommates at one point. So I think there's this kind of a love-hate relationship that you have with your best friends. You know, I mean, that these are people who are very close to you, but they're also, in a sense, very threatening because they know you. You know, they know how to hurt you in ways that somebody else doesn't know. So a best friend is somebody that you value both because they're there for you and because they don't use what they know against you. So it's like it's a complicated thing. And I guess on some level I wanted to use that as a metaphor, you know, with in the background for Peter and Harry's relationship. Plus there was this I always felt there was this kind of dynamic between them of this kind of unequal relationship, friendship, where there had to be a kind of jealousy that each of them felt for the other, you know, because on the one hand, you know, Peter does end up with Mary Jane, who was originally was Gwen originally with. I mean, it's like they went back and forth. They did the Betty and Veronica thing back and forth with those women. So there was a certain, you know, potential jealousy in that regard. But there was also this kind of jealousy in that Harry comes from money. Harry comes from wealth. Peter doesn't. So in a way, both of them envy the other. You know, that Peter obviously could envy Harry for his wealth and his social class and, you know, the ease of his life, you know, financially. But Harry also envies Peter for Peter's freedom from responsibility, ironically, you know, a family responsibility of having to live up to the father's expectations, you know. So there's a kind of an interesting dynamic there. And I just liked the idea of, you know, my best friend, my worst enemy, you know, this as a dynamic, especially since Harry, you know, would have this kind of psychotic break where I could go back and forth, you know, he could be his friend and not his friend and not his friend, you know, back and forth. So that was kind of fun. I just found it as a potential gold mine for stories. And there's this other aspect too that villains in my mind are always at their best when they have complicated emotional history, where you can feel some empathy and sympathy for them. And certainly I think you could feel that for Harry.
Yeah, without question. And I mean, I think you were working on Web of Spider-Man when JMD did that spectacular story, right? So I mean, did you two confer with each other at all? No. When he was working on that, he just did his thing, and
not really. I mean, I was sort of, there was a sort of compartmentalized. One of the things that I'd asked Jim Salicrup when I came back to writing Spider-Man was how much we were going to try to interweave the three titles, you know, Spectacular Web and Amazing. And I was going to be doing two of the titles. So, you know, I recognized that they were the subordinate titles and that all of the main storylines were going to be played out in Amazing. So I was going to basically have the secondary supporting cast to deal with, which is why I did the whole storylines with Robbie Robertson and Tombstone and J. Jonah Jameson and so on, because I couldn't really do stories that would affect the main, you know, relationships of Peter and Mary Jane and Aunt May and so on. So I didn't really confer with DeMatteis about it. But I was happy with what he did because it seemed like a great, you know, a great thematic a fulfillment, you know, of that story.
Yeah, without question. And you know, just as a total aside, not related, I'm glad you mentioned the Joe Robbie and Tombstone story, because that's one of my favorites, and that's a story that a lot of fans always come back to in terms of, like, you know, underrated, unheralded stories. I mean, are there any other from that web of run that you're particularly proud of?
It was an odd run. I mean, it was not just web; it was spectacular, and I tried to weave the two of them together the way that. What I was trying to do with that was what I had done when I was writing Batman and Detective Comics at DC. I actually had the opportunity to write what amounted to a biweekly Batman series, because I was writing both Batman and Detective, and I would do the stories so that they would dovetail into each other, you know. And that was kind of what I was trying to do with Spectacular and Web, you know, is to try to create storylines that I could keep going between the two books. So I don't, with the exception of the Robbie Robertson storyline, I don't have a storyline that I specifically think of as an arc in that. It's more like the interweaving of the stories that I was happiest about, you know, that I could, you know, pick up on a character beat, you know, from one issue and then fulfill it, you know, in a completely different book, thereby forcing readers hopefully to buy both.
Do you have a character that you invented in your time on, like, Amazing, or like a villain that you invented that you're particularly fond of? I mean, I know everybody probably always asked you about the Gwen story, but like, is there one that stands out to you personally?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of... yes, there are characters I... Obviously, the Punisher, you know, I mean, without... It goes without saying, but I like the... I mean, I'm I enjoy the Jackal. I hope that they'll find a place for him in the Amazing Spider-Man movies. And I think they might, because I think Miles Warren is being... is referenced in some of the... you know, the viral stuff that they're doing to promote the Amazing Spider-Man,
or like the Tumblr, or yeah.
So there's some reference to Miles Warren in some of that somewhere. You know, Professor Miles Warren at Empire State University. You know, so that would be kind of cool. I liked the Tarantula was one of my favorite creations from that period. The idea of a bad Captain America, basically. I thought that was kind of cool. You know, I had a handful of characters that I got to work on. Tombstone, obviously, another great character that I was happy with. Hammerhead, you know, there were a bunch of them. For some reason, Spider-Man and Firestorm as books both gave me the opportunity to create some really cool rogues gallery type villains, and some not so cool. You know, I mean, there are some that are completely forgettable, you know, but I did have a few that I was happy with.
Jerry, I know we've taken a lot of your time here, so, but if we can kind of end things with a really all-encompassing question. I mean, you obviously have a real good sense of humor about what you've written. I mean, do you when people do talk about, you know the death of Gwen and that whole era of books being like, you know, the end of the Silver Age, the end of innocence, Do you feel at this point, do you embrace it? Do you deflect it? Can you wrap your head around it? Or what's?
I absolutely embrace it. I feel really privileged, first of all, that I was part of a terrific era in comics, the Silver Age and the transition into the Bronze Age. I can't express how lucky I feel for that. If I had planned it, I could take some pride and credit, in making that transition from the Silver Age into the Bronze Age, the growing up of comics or whatever. But that was something that was recognized well after the fact. And to me, it's a wonderful irony, because on a personal level, it was very painful at the time. I got a lot of heat, as I said. I used to joke, that I was the most hated man in comics. And for a while I was kind of, seriously hated by people. But now, as you say, I'm sort of this legendary figure. And it's kind of funny to me that the stuff that I was beaten up for in the past, becomes material that's considered, if not because of the quality of the writing, because I can't say that the quality of the writing is any better than or worse than anybody else's, but for the historical significance that it had, is kind of remembered. That's kind of cool, that to me is it's a great privilege, and I'm really happy to have that in my resume, as it were. When I write up my bios for conventions, that I always put down, the man who killed Gwen Stacy. Because in fact, if I ever write a memoir, I'll probably call that my memoir, just because that's the thing that I did, for good or ill, was a defining moment of my comic book career, at least at that stage of my life. So, I peaked early. What can I say? It's all been downhill for the last 40 years.
But what a peak!
it's pretty cool. I mean, it's cool to look back at it and to recognize it for what it was. But I guarantee none of us thought that's what we were doing. We were just trying to tell a good story and keep the readers interested and do the kind of thing that seemed like the right thing to do at the time. It seemed like a good idea at the time, and it turned out we were right. So,
history has proven you right. Well, Dan, do you have anything else you want to throw in there? No,
I think that's a good place to end this.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, thanks again so much for doing this. We really do appreciate it. And I'm sure our fans are going to really love listening to this. This was definitely as comprehensive as it gets in terms of all the ins and outs, and I know you've been probably answering a lot of these questions, ad nauseum. So, we appreciate you going one more round with a couple of fans here while we're doing it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Amazing friends.
So thanks again to Jerry for coming on this show. Dan, that was some interview, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how we could top that.
Let's get Stan on, right?
No. Yeah, that's our challenge. That's our next challenge.
Well, Dan, where else can we find our Superior Spider Talk podcast?
Well, you can always find them at superiorspidertalk.com or on iTunes by searching Superior Spider Talk. And if you do, we'd really like you guys to leave us a rating and a comment to let us know how we're doing, how we can improve possibly, or what you do like what that we're doing. And, of course, we're always going to read it on the air. And if you have any opinions on these comics discussed today or questions maybe for future guests, please email them to us at superiorspidertalk@gmail.com, and we will address and read those on the air as well.
Yes, and please be sure to check our Facebook page at facebook.com/SuperiorSpiderTalk, because it's a great place to keep up with us in between shows as we post articles that we've written, other breaking news about the Spider-Man universe, how to get in touch with us, what comics we might be talking about, classic and current on our podcast. go to Facebook. That's where you'll find all that info.
Of course. And, Mark, where can we find all the info about you on the internet this week?
Oh, well, this week? No. You can, of course, find me every day at www.chasingamazingblog.com, where we're in the midst of our top 10 Green Goblin storyline countdown. Probably some of these Jerry Conway stories that we talked about today might be figuring into that countdown very soon, don't you think, Dan?
Probably. Just probably.
And additionally, you can find me on Twitter at ChasingASMBlog, on Facebook at facebook.com/ChasingAmazing. And you can find my weekly column about 90s comics, gimmick or good, at Comics Should Be Good at Comic Book Resources.
And you can find all my writings on Spider-Man at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com or follow us on Twitter at SupSpiderTalk. You can find everything about me at DanGavazdan.com or by following me on Twitter at DanGavazdan. And if you're really interested in more things that I do, you can check out my movie reviews at GrindMyReels.com or my weekly writings for the magazine What Weekly at WhatWeekly.com.
Sounds like a lot, Dan. I think you officially now have more .coms and posts than I do on the internet.
And I officially have way less hair than you.
Well, Dan, you know, I don't know if we have a good Uncle Ben story. You know, maybe something about a woman getting thrown off a bridge and her neck snapping. But I don't know. Either way, let's just remember that with great podcasts must also come superior spider talk. Snap.